Well, hey, everybody, and a special welcome if you're joining us for the first time. If that's you, you picked a great weekend to jump in. We're beginning a seven-week series that we've called Signs. And for 7 weeks, we're going to explore what just might be the most influential document in all of human history. It contains incredible detail about the mission and the ministry of Jesus. It's a book that you find in your New Testament, which is in itself a library of books, but this one is called John. It's the account of Jesus' life written by a man named John. And it's going to be, I couldn't be more excited for where we're going to go in the next few weeks. But as many of you know, along with this study, we're inviting you to read John's words for yourself. And so to that end, we've printed a bookmark with a seven-week reading plan. So each week there's like a prescribed reading. And before you get overwhelmed, the entire Gospel of John is really not that long. And so you're just assigned a few chapters each week. And my hope is that you would read it maybe even a few times and then maybe note in the margins of whatever you're reading in, the questions that surface, and maybe even have some conversations about the content with whoever you do life with. And you can grab the bookmark for free at the Next Steps desk on your way out. And as Randy mentioned, we've also reserved a few hundred copies of a very special edition of the Gospel of John. It's by a company called Alabaster that we found on the internet, which I think that internet thing is going to hang around with us. So there you go with that. But really an incredible way to experience John. They set the text on beautiful paper with stunning pictures. It's sort of a new way to get to kind of take in the Gospel of John. And so pick one of those up if you'd like. And of course, you can read John's Gospel for free online or in any Bible that you have lying around your house. So this week, we're inviting you all to read John chapter 1 through 6. And so I have thrown down the gauntlet, and you can pick up the gauntlet if you so desire. So to get us going with the series, what I want to do first is give you a little bit of background on this man, John, who wrote this account of Jesus' life, a few things you should know about him before you read his words. John was one of the first people to follow Jesus. He was one of the 12 original disciples. And not only that, he was likely the youngest of the disciples. Scholars argue that because he lives longer than any of the others, lives up into the early 90s AD. And it was pretty typical in the first century for Jewish teachers who called disciples. They would pick one that was a bit older to sort of be the leader of the followers, and that would be Peter in the case of Jesus, and then one younger, and again, most scholars believe that was John. One of my favorite details about John, and if you're paying attention as you read his account of Jesus' life, you're going to see this. John, when he refers to himself in his gospel, identifies himself as the disciple Jesus loved. Isn't that awesome? He'd be like, and Peter and Andrew were getting in the boat along with the disciple who Jesus loved, right? And I just think that's so much fun. He even calls himself that right at the resurrection scene, which is just brilliant, like the most significant moment in history. And he was like, oh yeah, just so you guys remember, I was the one that Jesus loved, right? So I think someday in heaven, he'll have to have a chit chat about how humility is important for followers of Jesus. I'm just saying. But John was an eyewitness to the life and ministry of Jesus. So he heard Jesus teach with his own ears. He saw Jesus heal with his own eyes. He was there at the Last Supper, the night Jesus took the bread and broke it and said, this bread represents my body, which will be broken for you. And he picked up the cup of wine and said, this cup represents a new covenant in my blood. John would have been there to experience that firsthand. He was there that night in the Garden of Gethsemane when Jesus is arrested. And he was there at the foot of the cross as Jesus passed from this life. And it's just interesting to think about, because at that moment when Jesus died, John believed that everything sort of was over as far as Jesus was concerned. He didn't believe anything more about Jesus at that point. But then 3 days later, John came face to face with the resurrected Jesus. He himself was one of the first human beings on planet Earth to be confronted with something that was simultaneously unbelievable and yet undeniable. Jesus was alive again. And from that moment, John's life took a very dramatic turn, and he spent the rest of his life telling everyone he could about Jesus, who he was, what he said, what he did, and why it matters. But eventually, decades after the resurrection, John ends up serving as a pastor to a group of churches, which is what is in an area called Asia Minor today. It's the western edge of Turkey, right along the Aegean Sea, and it's kind of centered in the city of Ephesus. But John becomes an old man, and he's still telling the stories about Jesus, but he realizes he doesn't have forever on planet Earth, and he doesn't want what he knows to be true of Jesus to go away when he passes. And so the day eventually comes where he sits down, either holding a quill himself, or maybe he was dictating to someone else who could write for him what he knew to be true about Jesus, what he saw, what he heard, what he experienced. And what's stunning to me is you think about it, John writes these words decades after the crucifixion and resurrection, which means he's had a lifetime of not only teaching these stories, but reflecting on what they meant, contemplating their implications. And so through all of that, John discerns what is most important for future generations, including us, to know about Jesus. And he organizes his gospel accordingly. And John's gospel is his legacy. It's his gift to the world. And so with this series, as we sort of enter John's memories, we get to journey with him as he journeyed with Jesus. And we're going to explore seven miracles, one per week, that John includes in his account of Jesus' life. And what's interesting about these miracles is that John doesn't call them miracles. He calls them signs. And scholars argue that he does this because he wants us to point us beyond the miraculous in the moment to something that is way more universal. In other words, John wants us to know that these miracles of Jesus weren't random. They were done on purpose and for a purpose. They were done to communicate something to us. And so before we dig into the first sign, which is where we'll spend the bulk of our time today, what I need to do is I need to address a tension that surfaces in John's gospel. And it has to do with one of the most misused words in all of Christianity. That word is belief. And what's funny about the word belief is that outside of a religious context, we all know what belief means. But for some reason, the rules change when it gets inserted into religious conversations. Here's what I mean. You might think of it this way. In the real world, we believe based on evidence. Things we see, things we hear, things we read, and the confidence we have in the person delivering the information to us. And think about it this way. I mean, I was thinking this week about, I've got elementary schoolers at my house and they're learning the multiplication tables, right? And so they learn from their teacher that 8 times 8 equals 64, right? Just like you and I learned many moons ago. Not one of my boys has come home though and lined up 8 rows of 8 Legos and counted. And the reason they don't do that is because they trust their teacher. They trust that what their teacher is telling them is true. They trust the source, and so they believe the information. That's how it always works until we get into religion, because things get weird with religious belief. Many, many of us were introduced to religious belief as something completely divorced from reason. It's like evidence and logic weren't welcomed as a part of our training in faith. And that may be your story. If you grew up in church, you may have even had a moment where you asked a question of somebody in leadership at your church and you received an answer that went something like this: stop asking questions and just believe. And for somebody in my line of work, it's amazing how often I hear that story and how often a moment like that sends someone down a path to an eventual crisis of faith. In fact, this past fall, I met with a new Keystone friend at Starbucks, because that's always the Lord's will, you know what I'm saying? And that was his story. And he wanted to have coffee with me because he said, you know, I feel like I've been a part of Keystone for a while now and I'm starting to actually believe in Jesus. And he said, you know, partly I think it's because for the first time, you're presenting a version of faith that encourages me to actually consider the evidence. And he had confessed that he had long struggled to reconcile faith and reason. He grew up in a tradition that basically said his questions were evidence of a lack of faith, and that his need for evidence could be overcome if he just believed. And he said, but the problem with that is I don't even know how to do that. I want to do that, but I can't seem to get myself there in a way that's intellectually honest. And so even though he'd been a churchgoer for decades, he said, I always wondered if I'd ever really be able to cross the line of faith, even though I wanted to. But he says, then a friend invited me to Keystone for an Easter service. And he said, I felt like the sermon was for me. I'm glad you invited other people, but like we could have just had coffee, because what you did was you put these questions on the board at the beginning of the talk. And he goes, those were my questions. And I thought, the pastor isn't supposed to be acknowledging these questions. Because he said, you didn't just say you need to believe more. You said you need to rethink these questions in light of the evidence for the physical resurrection of Jesus. And he goes, I was stunned. All of a sudden, the wheels started turning. And he said, you know, I started to realize that my questions and being honest about my questions was actually a necessary part of my journey towards faith. Well, that was this past fall. And I mean, that was one of the things that for me sparked the idea behind this series. Because the good news behind this series is when it comes to Jesus, you don't need to just stop asking questions and believe. You can examine real evidence and come to real and trustworthy conclusions. And John, in his account of Jesus' life, can be incredibly helpful on that journey. And here's why. When you read John, you're going to start to notice that John didn't just give us content when he wrote about Jesus. He didn't just tell us what Jesus did. He told us why Jesus did what he did. In fact, at the end of John's account, he gives us a purpose statement for his gospel. And that's interesting. You remember from high school, you'd write a paper and you kind of have a purpose statement. Here's John's purpose statement. He says this. He says, Jesus performed many other signs, so many other miracles, in the presence of his disciples, which are not recorded in this book. So he says, you've just experienced my account of Jesus' life, and I want you to know I did some editing. Jesus did many other signs in the presence of his disciples. There were 12 of us, and there were a whole bunch of beyond the 12, and we all saw this. But he said, I didn't record them in this book, which raises a question. Okay, so John, you edited, and you edited and organized for a purpose. What is that purpose? And he tells us in the next verse. He says, but these, like the seven I showed you, these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Messiah, or the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. I wrote these for you so that you could believe. It isn't just that you would know what Jesus said and did. I want you to believe, and I want you to find life. It's like John wants us 2,000 years later to journey through his account and reach a moment where we're convinced that Jesus was who he claimed to be. He doesn't just tell us what to believe. He builds a case as to why we should believe. He wants us to find and follow Jesus. So he actually shares the sequence of events from the perspective of decades later, the sequence of events that led him to faith in Jesus, that led him to a spot where he believed in Jesus. So with that as a background, I'm going to jump into the first sign with you today. And it's actually a story that people have been familiar with for almost 2,000 years. In fact, by the time John writes his account of this story, he doesn't even describe the miracle because he assumes his readers already know about the miracle. The first sign is water to wine. And I kind of like that because it rhymes. Sign and wine. There you go, Dr. Seuss. I was like, oh, just noticed that and it wasn't funny. Moving on. Okay, John chapter 2 is where you'll find this miracle. And here's the setup. Here's what John tells us. He says, on the third day, a wedding took place in Cana in Galilee. So Galilee is a region in Israel. It's a region in which there would be many, many small towns. And so he says, okay, in the Galilee, so up north in Israel, this town is called Cana. He says, Jesus' mother was there. So Mary was present at the celebration. And Jesus and his disciples had also been invited to the wedding. Now, before we go any further, you need to know something. When John tells us that the wedding happened on the third day, he's alerting us to something that his first century audience would have caught. Because people who spent time in the Jewish scriptures and people who were familiar with some of the Christian texts knew that the third day is always in the Bible when something new begins. In the Jewish tradition, it was on the third day that God descended on Mount Sinai and met with the people and gave them the Ten Commandments. The third day for Christians is the day that Jesus returns from the grave. And John's readers, again, would have noticed, like when John says it's the third day, we need to lean in, we need to pay attention. He's trying to tell us something new is about to begin, and it's about to happen or start happening at this wedding. Well, weddings in the first century were a little different than weddings are today. Weddings in the first century, you'd invite your entire village and all the extended family members, and they would go on for days. So this was like a very expensive proposition. And all of you who have daughters who will someday get married are thinking, I'm so glad that we changed that tradition, because that sounds terrifyingly expensive. And it was. But that reality that these were festivals or feasts for lots of people for many days sets up the seriousness of what John tells us next. So in the next verse, he says, when the wine was gone, and we could just stop reading there, right? I mean, this is the first century, and wine to them was much safer than water, and it was also a lot more fun than water. And so you're at a party, and the wine is gone. You go, what do you mean the wine is gone? This would have been terribly embarrassing to the bride's family, to the groom's family. It would have been awkward for everyone else there as they're walking around trying to find wine. And so when the wine was gone, Jesus' mother, Mary, said to him, they have no more wine. And here's where this gets fun. I don't think she tells him just to tell him. She knows some stuff. And we don't know that she knows some stuff from this text, but I don't think it's like, hey, they have no more wine. That's a bummer. We should go buy some more. I think Mary knows that Jesus can do something about the lack of wine, which actually makes me wonder what it was like to raise Jesus, right? I mean, did Mary ever have to run to the store last minute? Or was she in the kitchen and she's like, oh no. And she's like, hey, Jesus. Yeah, mom. We're out of hummus again. And I was just wondering, I mean, you know, and actually, Joseph likes it with a little extra garlic. So if you could just, I won't look. I know I can't look. We'll just, I'm over here doing the dishes. You just do the hummus thing and we'll come back at it. We don't know that that ever happened. So hold your emails. It probably didn't. But, right? But Mary has a sense that Jesus can do something about this problem. And so she turns to him and Jesus responds. And when I show you how Jesus responds, just get a kind of wait for it, because it's not what it looks like initially. So they have no more wine. Jesus says, woman, why do you involve me? See what I mean? Yeah. If you're taking notes and you're a teenager, don't ever say this to your mom. Okay? And don't ever say Jesus said it to his mom, because that's not going to help your case. Okay? So the word woman in the Greek language is actually, the word translated woman is actually a formal, respectful way to address. And I was trying to figure out a way to convey that. It would be like if he said, my lady, but that sounds too weird and British. So, but you get the idea. It's like a respectful way to say, woman, why do you involve me? Jesus replied. Then he says this, and this is really interesting. My hour has not yet come. In other words, you know what I'm here for. I know what I'm here for. The time will come where I'm supposed to start letting people know what I'm here for, but this isn't the time. Like, I was sent to rescue the world, not rescue the wedding reception, okay? And what's great is, as you read this, as you continue to read, it isn't what John tells us. It's that you have to enter your imagination, because there's a jump in the story. And so it's almost like Jesus says, woman, why do you involve me? My hour is not yet come. And in my imagination, I just see Mary giving Jesus the mom look. Are you familiar with the mom look? Yeah, that look that can move mountains, right? She just looks at him, and then I imagine Jesus maybe looks at his feet. I don't know, right? And the reason I think this is that Mary then starts walking towards the kitchen, and here's what she says, and this is awesome. She says to the servants, do whatever he tells you. She knows he's going to do it. His mama told him to do it, right? So she says, just do whatever he tells you. And so then John gives us a little bit of context to help us understand what comes next. He says this. He says, nearby stood six stone water jars, the kind used by the Jews for ceremonial washing, each holding from 20 to 30 gallons. So what you see here is, we learn later that these are not currently full, but there's the potential for well over 100 gallons of water. And John tells us these are the kind that the Jews, which he was a Jew, used for ceremonial washing. You're like, what does that mean? Well, what this tells us is that the families that were involved in this wedding are very, very strong in their faith. They were trying to live out the Old Testament rules of life as interpreted through the lens of their first century culture. And the rabbis in the first century had developed a very intricate system of ceremonial washing. They would say you would do some things that would leave you ceremonially unclean, and then you would use some ceremonial water to sort of restore your purity. So this was a normal practice for these families, and that's why they had these stone water jars sitting there near where the wedding was. But what's interesting is that as I was studying this passage, scholars argue that in John's gospel, these jars are the key to understanding the story, because they represent the Old Testament traditions that Jesus had come to replace. They were a physical embodiment of all the rules surrounding God's covenant with Israel, that covenant made at Mount Sinai with Moses. And as the narrative continues, Jesus is going to leverage an icon of what would soon be replaced to point to something new that would be put into place. His actions affirm that the Old Testament covenant was coming to its intended end in Jesus, and that something new was on the horizon. I don't know if John caught this in the moment, but decades later, he saw it with clarity. I found a theologian by the name of F.F. Bruce, as a British theologian, and he said something just brilliant about this story, way smarter than I could ever come up with. So I'm just going to read it to you. And you know he's good because he uses his first two initials. Do you know about this in theology, people? If you're reading like some really smart person, they just use their initials like C.S. Lewis. You're like, that dude's got game. Okay, yeah. Anyway, here's what F.F. Bruce says. He says, the water provided for purification as laid down by the Jewish law and customs stand for the whole ancient order of Jewish ceremony, which Christ was to replace with something better. And when you see the word better, I know what you're thinking, like, ooh, that's kind of harsh. But he's not saying that the Old Testament and the Old Covenant didn't have an incredibly important purpose. He's like, it just was sort of setting the table for what was to come, and what was to come was better. And so jumping back in the story, John tells us, Jesus said to the servants, fill the jars with water. So they filled them to the brim. Now, this would have been something servants did regularly. They had no idea what was going to happen. They're like, okay, this is weird. We're at the wedding. We're filling the jars. So they fill the jars. And now he tells them to do something they'd never done before. Now, draw some out, like in a cup, and take it to the master of the banquet. And notice, John doesn't even tell us like the miracles happened. It's just there. Again, everybody knew what was going on. Draw some out and take it to the master of the banquet. The master of the banquet is like the head waiter. He's in charge of what is served and the order in which things are served. And so there's this really interesting moment where the master of the banquet takes a sip out of the cup while all the servants who brought it to him are watching. And then he says this. They did so. And the master of the banquet tasted, and here's our first clue, the water that had now been turned into wine. He did not realize where it had come from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew and were all standing there with their eyes really big, right? I mean, it was a moment. He continues, he says this. Then he, the head waiter, called the bridegroom aside and said, and this would be like a confrontation. I don't know if you do this. It's like a loving confrontation, because this guy has broken protocol, and though he doesn't know it, calls the bridegroom aside and said, everyone brings out the choice wine, that's like the good wine, first, and then the cheaper wine after the guests have had too much to drink, right? This is why Trader Joe's has literally sold over a billion bottles of two-buck chuck, okay? Never had any, I just read about it. Serious. Okay, no. So, yeah, the cheaper wine after the guests have had too much to drink. But, he says, you have saved the best until now. Like, this is the better stuff. In other words, what were you thinking? Everybody brings out the good wine first and then the cheap wine when everyone's had too much to drink and they don't really care, right? But you've saved the best for last. And I think the bridegroom would have just been stunned, but because of the miracle, that's how it had happened. And John wants us to know that God had saved the best for last as well. Just as the original wine set the table for the better wine that was to come later in the wedding feast, the Jewish sacrificial system set the stage for a better covenant that was coming. It's like through the nation of Israel, God established a covenant that would set up the world to expect someone to come after, to fulfill that covenant, and to establish a better one. And the Jews called this someone the Messiah or the Christ. We call that someone Jesus. You don't even have to take my word for it. There's a New Testament letter not written by John. We're not sure who wrote it, but it's called Hebrews. And you can just imagine there were Jewish people who placed their faith in Jesus, that came to believe in Jesus, and they were struggling with, what do we do with all of these rules and regulations from the Old Testament time? I mean, what are we supposed to do? How are we supposed to reconcile them with the new thing that's in Jesus? And so this letter called Hebrews goes out to these Jewish Christians to sort of explain to them what was going on with the arrival of Jesus on planet Earth. Again, I don't know that the non-Jewish people would have had these questions, but for the Jews, this was a big deal. And here's what the author of Hebrews tells us. He says, but Jesus is the mediator of a better covenant, which has been enacted through better promises. It's a new deal. It's a new way. And the Jews would have had a sense that this was coming. There's an Old Testament prophet who talks about the day that God will establish a new covenant with Israel, and it won't be like the covenant he established at Mount Sinai, because that covenant was broken. But in this new covenant, he's like going to write his law on their hearts, and he's going to forgive their sins. He won't remember their sins anymore. And so they knew it was coming, but it's like the author of Hebrews is saying, listen, but Jesus is the mediator of the new covenant, of the better covenant, which is enacted through better promises. He goes on. He says, for if that first covenant had been faultless, there wouldn't have been no need to look for a second one. He says, you know it's not perfect. That's why you had to keep sacrificing all the animals in the temple, because you kept sinning and you kept breaking God's law and you had to keep making it right. We needed a new system. We needed a better system. And God provided a better system. Then he says this. And speaking of a new covenant, as in Jesus' Last Supper, he's made the first one obsolete. And to be clear, there was nothing wrong with the first covenant, but it was fulfilled. It fulfilled the purpose that God intended for it in setting the stage for what God would accomplish through Jesus. All that to say that turning water to wine was more than a miracle. It was a sign. John was trying to tell us something about the mission of Jesus. And it's interesting to me that John's narrative ends this way. John tells us what Jesus did here in Cana of Galilee was the first of the signs. As in, there's more to come, but this was the first of the signs through which he revealed his glory. And I love this. And his disciples believed in him. His disciples, something happened inside of them. They were confronted with evidence, and they came to faith. Now, their faith was wobbly, and they believed and unbelieved throughout their time with Jesus, and then the resurrection, and then they believed. But in this moment, they believed in him, and you say, well, okay, so they believed because they actually were confronted with evidence that was undeniable. And say, absolutely. They believed because there was reason to believe, and that's John's point. And what you're going to find is that throughout John's gospel, this happens over and over and over again. There's a pattern. Nobody's asked to believe in Jesus without evidence. And if you're here and you're seeking for the first time, or you disengaged and you're wandering back into church and you can't believe we're having this conversation right now, you're probably thinking, okay, that's great for them 2,000 years ago, but what about us? How are we supposed to look at some of these stories? And I'm so glad you asked. Because unlike John, our faith doesn't come by seeing. But that doesn't mean that we don't have evidence to consider. We're invited to believe based on the testimony of the people who were there. People, it should be noted, whose accounts have been seen as trustworthy for 2,000 years. These accounts were passed on over and over and over again, because over and over and over again, people affirmed that they were true. People like John wrote what they had experienced so that generations later, people like us could follow the signs and come to believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Messiah, the Son of God, and that once we believe, we find life in his name, both now and into eternity. And so what's fun for me is before this series is over, we get to explore all seven of the signs described by John. And my prayer is that more than a few of us will find ourselves crossing that line of faith at some point during these conversations. And we cross it not just because we will ourselves to believe something we don't understand, but because we consider the evidence of John, who was an eyewitness to the life and ministry of Jesus, an eyewitness whose words can be trusted. Would you stand, and I'll close us in prayer. Heavenly Father, I pray for those of us that enter this series with a longing to believe and doubt that that's even possible. I pray that your Spirit would be at work in our midst, that you would be opening doors in our heart to faith, while at the same time confronting us with the evidence of those who've gone before us, those who were eyewitnesses to Jesus, what he said, what he did. For others of us, I just pray that you would reactivate a sense of wonder. If our faith has grown stale, I pray that something in these ancient accounts, as we explore them one by one, we would find ourselves just taken back in awe of your plan, of your love for us. But for now, for this moment, we just say thank you. Thank you for John. Thank you for his words. Thank you for preserving them so faithfully. I pray that this study would be just an incredibly rich time for us as a community to fall deeper in love with you. And so we bless you. We thank you. We love you and desire to love you more. In the matchless name of your Son, our Savior, Jesus Christ, we pray. Everyone said, amen. Friends, before you leave, we're starting something new. If you'd like to pray with someone after the service, we have a few people right over here with name tags on. They would love to pray with you. Otherwise, go in peace. Be sure to grab your bookmark on the way out. We'll see you next week.